Chapter 22. Meditations in the Mango Grove. However disinclined Banerjee and I felt to accept Ananda Mayi as God incarnate, we saw no reason to question the fact that she lived in a state of consciousness that transcended the waking state as much as the waking state transcends sleep, or that she possessed psychic powers of a high order. Guru Priya's 7 Bengali volumes of reminiscences, running translations from which Banerjee sometimes gave for my benefit, related hundreds of anecdotes of inedia, levitation, telepathy, clairvoyance, prophecy, and other supernormal phenomena, such as may be found in plenty not only in the biographies of the saints and mystics of all religions, but even, occasionally, in the less illumined lives of ordinary men and women everywhere. Several anecdotes related to phenomena witnessed not only by Guru Priya, but by one or more of the other ashramites. But by the time we met Ananda Mayi, such occurrences had become rare, and devotees of long standing in fact remarked that, though she still persisted in certain eccentricities, her behaviour was much more normal than it had been up to a few years earlier. We ourselves witnessed only one incident that might be regarded as being in any way out of the ordinary. Towards the end of the afternoon, Ananda Mayi, followed by an entourage that would have done credit to a queen, used to stroll a few furlongs up the road to a stretch of open ground, on the right from which we could see, through the purple haze, first the tiny white cubes of bungalows high up on the hillside, and then, as evening deepened, the pinpoints of orange light that flashed from one building after another. The untidy girl always struggled along with a large bucket of water. No one else was allowed to touch it, as it was one of Ananda Mayi's minor eccentricities to perform in the open, among the bushes, functions usually reserved for a more private place. She would then sit on a low ridge, enjoying the cool breeze that blew from the mountains. Often, while talking, she would shake down her long hair. Then, with graceful, coquettish movements of her hands, she could use them well enough for this purpose, it seemed, however useless they might be for eating and washing, twist it up into a topknot, then shake it down over her eyes, then toss it back, all the time casting at one or two favoured ashramites bewitching smiles and the archest of glances. Sometimes her hair would be admiringly combed by women devotees, who plucked out any grey threads they happened to find. Combings were, of course, piously treasured. One afternoon, as we set out from the ashram, Ananda Mayi gave instructions that a large tray of fruits offered to her a few minutes earlier should be taken along with us. This was so unusual that several ashramites, divining a hidden significance in the order, asked her for what purpose the fruits were required. But, as she often did when unwilling to answer a question, she only laughed. A few hundred yards along the road stood the local branch of the Ramakrishna Mission. At the very moment that Ananda Mayi, who led the procession, drew level with the gate, out came 4 or 5 swamis. On seeing her, they started back with every expression of extreme embarrassment. They seemed more embarrassed still when Ananda Mayi, kicking off her shoes, took the tray of fruits and, with the greatest deference, presented it to the senior-most swami. We afterwards learned that these monks, jealous of the greater popularity of her ashram, had been spreading ugly scandals about her, and that she had decided, as it appeared, to teach them a lesson. The meeting at the gate could have been fortuitous, but never before had we seen the swamis going out together at that hour, and never before had a tray of fruits been taken with us on our walk. According to the Buddhist tradition, it is the fourth dhyana, or superconscious state, which is the base for the development of supernormal powers. So that any person regularly manifesting such powers may be assumed to have made considerable progress in meditation, that is, shamatha bhavana. Despite our dissatisfaction with Anandamayi's attitude towards the caste system, Banerjee and I therefore decided, after long and earnest discussion, to seek her approval and advice regarding our own decision to take up the regular practice of Anapanasati, or respiration mindfulness. Whether the distinction between the exalted but still mundane states of consciousness that can be attained through continuous practice of the proper spiritual exercise on the one hand, and the transcendental faculty of wisdom, prajna, in its distinctively Buddhist sense of an awakening to the true absolute nature of existence, through which alone freedom and enlightenment can be attained on the other, was as clear to us then as it became subsequently, I would hesitate to affirm. But it was clear enough to me at least to conclude, not only from Anandamayi's social orthodoxy, which implies an absence of compassion, the emotional equivalent of wisdom, but also from the banality of her sayings, a volume of which had been translated into English, as well as from her general outlook, and though to a lesser degree, from the whole atmosphere of the ashram, that, though a great yogini, she was neither enlightened, in the Buddhist sense, nor even on the path to enlightenment, except to the extent that shamatha, though incapable of giving birth to prajna, may yet constitute a basis for its eventual development. Consequently, we had no intention of taking her as our guru or personal spiritual teacher. Like all Hindus, the ashramites were unaware of the difference between a superconscious and a transcendental state, and since their bigotry made it impossible for us to confide our views to them, they found our attitude towards the blissful mother unsatisfactory, especially as we only bowed and saluted her with folded hands, instead of falling prostrate at her feet, as they always did. Having made up our minds to ask Anandamayi's advice about meditation, we requested her to grant us a private interview. This took place the same night, between 11 and 12. The ashramites had warned us that the mother hardly ever granted such interviews, and then only for a few minutes, and the fact that the two black sheep of the ashram should be thus highly favoured so soon after their arrival gave rise to many murmurs and much heart-burning. "I've been Ma's devotee for years," complained more than one person bitterly, "and she's never given me a private interview." Even the crane-necked youth, we were astonished to learn, had not enjoyed this favour. But we were too excited to take much notice of their reactions. Banerjee, who had no previous experience of meditation, was as eager to practice respiration mindfulness as I was, for he already knew about my experiment with this method in Singapore. Anandamayi apparently had not heard of Anapanasati before, but when, with Banerjee as interpreter, I explained in detail the successive stages of the practice, she nodded approvingly. Most of the interview was devoted to hints of a general nature, which, as we afterwards discovered, were matters of common knowledge. But one hint on how one pointedness of mind that had been lost at a higher stage of the practice could be recovered at a lower stage proved useful during the whole of my subsequent practice of this method. At the conclusion of the interview, Banerjee asked her to bestow on him a religious name. I was already known as Dharmapriya, or Lover of the Law, having adopted the name in Calcutta. Anandamayi therefore named Banerjee Satyapriya, or Lover of Truth. Both of us felt strangely moved and elated by this interview, which not only gave a final sanction to our decision to enter the path of meditation, but stamped it as irrevocable. And it was with profounder bows than usual that we retired from Anandamayi's presence and walked in silence beneath the starry vastness of night back to the sleeping mango grove, where in the morning our practice was to begin. For the next 3 or 4 weeks, in fact until the day of our departure from Kishengunj, Satchapriya, as my friends must now be called, and I meditated twice daily, at dawn and at dusk, in one of the small clearings in the strip of jungle running from the mango grove down to the canal. One's first experience of meditation, like one's first love, retains in memory a virginal freshness, too delicate and too delicious for words. We meditated for an hour at a time, sitting cross-legged, with spine erect, chin tucked in, and loosely closed hands resting, thumbs upwards, on our knees. Our meditation seats, each of which consisted of a folded blanket covered with a clean towel, were placed about 20 feet apart. If one finished a few minutes before the other, as usually happened, he uncrossed his legs and quietly waited for him to move. At Anandamayi's suggestion, each of us maintained a spiritual diary, wherein, immediately after each meditation session, we recorded the degree of concentration attained, the kind of mental distraction that had arisen, and any unusual experiences that might have occurred. At 10 o'clock every morning, having breakfasted with Panditji and Sudhir in the tent, we always slept outside, we ran down to the canal to bathe. The iciness of these swift rushing waters, which roared so loudly between their narrow stone banks that we could hardly hear each other speak, contrasted with the intense heat of the mid-morning sun. Soon after Satchapriya's arrival, I had adopted Indian dress, a white shirt and sarong, so that soaping myself in the open air was no longer the problem it had been in Ahmedabad. But I could not help feeling slightly embarrassed by the glance of a wandering goatherd, or the inquisitive looks of the village boys sporting naked downstream. Washing clothes was now the problem. Usually Satchapriya, after soaping them, slapped both mine and his on a big flat stone, swinging each one up into the air and then down with a sudden jerk of his powerful arm, as he considered mine too feeble for the strenuous work. We then went to the ashram. As the time of our meditation session coincided with that of the bhajan, we stopped going in the evening. Instead, we passed the time quietly among the mango trees until Panditji and Sudhir returned. What experiences Satchapriya had in meditation I no longer remember, though each always showed the other his notebook. My own experiences were mostly in the form of visions. Once I saw the Virgin Mary, all in blue and white, as Murillo had depicted her. On another occasion, Anandamayi appeared. Once, again, I had a vision of the Buddha, but as I gazed, the nose suddenly became enormously elongated and his head turned into that of an elephant. When I asked Anandamayi the meaning of this strange occurrence, she explained that the Buddha had given me the sign of siddhi, or success, the elephant-headed god Ganesha being regarded by Hindus as the remover of all obstacles, both worldly and spiritual, and hence the giver of success in all undertakings. Presently I began to see beautiful landscapes. Then, as it were, white birds flashing through brilliant blue sky. And finally, kaleidoscopic geometrical patterns that seemed made of jewels. All these visions were remarkable for gem-like purity and brilliance of colour, as though one was being given glimpses of a higher and more beautiful world. Since we now spent much less time at the ashram, Satchapriya had fewer opportunities of coming into conflict with the ashramites. After our interview with Anandamayi, only a single such incident occurred. One Sunday, perhaps in honour of Hari Baba's birthday, there was a feast, and at the conclusion of the morning programme, practically the entire congregation was invited to remain for lunch. Since the guests were being fed in relays, we naturally expected our own lunch to be served late. But first 1, then 2 hours passed, and though almost everybody had finished eating, the ashramite either ignored Satchapriya's inquiries as to when we would be served, or curtly told him we would have to wait. Eventually, his face dark with rage, he said, "Come on, let's go. These buggers are trying to make fools of us." In vain I remonstrated that the ashramites were busy and assured him we would be served within a few minutes. Knowing as well as I did that we were being subtly insulted, he strode angrily out of the gate, and I had no alternative but to follow. Half an hour after we had reached the mango grove, the knight of the bucket rushed up in a state of great agitation. Anandamayi was calling us, he said, and we were to return to the ashram immediately. Lunch was ready. Satchapriya, feeling that the advantage now lay on our side, smoothly replied that, as we had just eaten a few mangoes, our stomachs were full. "Since we were practicing meditation," he added, "we ought not to overeat." When the youth had pleaded and expostulated long enough to assuage our wounded pride, however, we at last relented and returned with him to the ashram. Anandamayi was looking out for us from the balcony of her room, and as we rather shamefacedly entered the gate, she greeted us with an affectionate smile of unusual sweetness. Upstairs, where we had not been allowed before, she apologised with folded hands for the behaviour of the ashramites, and begged our forgiveness, so skilfully making their fault her own, as indeed it was, ultimately, that we felt obliged to beg her forgiveness for the rudeness of our abrupt departure. She then called for fruits and sweets, and gave them to us with her own hands. No one in the world, we felt, could be more charming than Anandamayi. When our lunch was at last ready, she stood and watched us eat, keeping the ashramites busy running to and fro between the kitchen and the north veranda for fresh helpings of the delicacies she had ordered to be specially cooked for us. We subsequently learned that, immediately after our departure, she inquired if we had been given lunch, and on discovering how we had been treated, had taken the ashramites severely to task for their behaviour. This incident would perhaps have led to an improvement in our position at the ashram, but Anandamayi, who had for some time been showing signs of restlessness, had already spent 6 weeks at Kishanganj. A day or two later, Gurupriya and a few other intimates was suddenly ordered to strike canvas, and she was gone.